Chapter 6. "Are you feeling faint?" asked Veltchaninov of his companion, frightened out of his wits. "I'll tell him to stop and get you some water, shall I?" She looked at him, angrily and reproachfully. "Where are you taking me to?" she answered, coldly and abruptly. "To a very beautiful house, Liza. There are plenty of children. They'll all love you there. They are so kind. Don't be angry with me, Liza. I wish you well, you know." In truth, Veltchaninov would have looked strange at this moment to any acquaintance, if such had happened to see him.
How—how—how—oh, how wicked you are!"
said Liza, fighting with suppressed tears and flashing her fine, angry eyes at him.
"But, Liza, I—you are bad, bad and wicked!"
cried Liza. She wrung her hands. Veltchaninov was beside himself.
"Oh, Liza, Liza, if only you knew what despair you are causing me," he said.
"Is it true that he is coming down tomorrow?" asked the child haughtily. "Is it true or not?"
"Quite true. I shall bring him down myself. I shall take him and bring him." "He will deceive you somehow,"
cried the child, drooping her eyes. "Doesn't he love you, then, Liza?"
"No."
"Has he ill-treated you?"
"Has he?"
Liza looked gloomily at her questioner and said nothing. She then turned away from him and sat still and depressed. Veltchaninov commenced to talk. He tried to win her. He spoke warmly, excitedly, feverishly. Liza listened incredulously and with a hostile air, but still she listened. Her attention delighted him beyond measure, and he went so far as to explain to her what it meant when a man took to drink. He said that he loved her, and would himself look after her father. At last, Liza raised her eyes and gazed fixedly at him. Then Veltchaninov began to speak of her mother, and of how well he had known her. And he saw that his tales attracted her. Little by little, she began to reply to his questions, but very cautiously and in an obstinately monosyllabic way. She would answer nothing to his chief inquiries, as to her former relations with her father, for instance. She maintained an obstinate silence. While speaking to her, Veltchaninov held the child's hand in his own as before, and she did not try to take it away. Liza said enough to make it apparent that she had loved her father more than her mother at first, because that her father had loved the child better than her mother did, but that when her mother had died and was lying dead, Liza wept over her and kissed her, and ever since then she had loved her mother more than all there was in the whole world, and that every night she thought of her and loved her. But Liza was very proud, and suddenly recollecting herself and finding that she was saying a great deal more than she had meant to reveal, she paused and relapsed into obstinate silence once more, and gazed at Veltchaninov with something like hatred in her eyes, considering that he had beguiled her into the revelations just made. By the end of the journey, however, her hysterical condition was nearly over, but she was very silent and sat looking morosely about her, obstinately silent and gloomy, like a little wild animal. The fact that she was being taken to a strange house, where she had never been before, did not seem so far to weigh upon her. Veltchaninov saw clearly enough that other things distressed her, and principally that she was ashamed, ashamed that her father should have let her go so easily, thrown her away, as it were, into Veltchaninov's arms.
"She's ill," thought the latter, "and perhaps very ill. She has been bullied and ill-treated. Oh, that drunken, blackguardly wretch of a fellow!"
He hurried on the coachman. Veltchaninov trusted greatly to the fresh air, to the garden, to the children, to the new life now. As to the future, he was in no sort of doubt at all. His hopes were clear and defined. One thing he was quite sure of, and that was that he had never before felt what now swelled within his soul,
and that the sensation would last for ever and ever. I have an object at last. This is life, he said to himself enthusiastically. Many thoughts welled into his brain just now, but he would have none of them. He did not care to think of details at this moment, for without details the future was all so clear and beautiful, and so safe and indestructible. The basis of his plan was simple enough. It was simply this, in the language of his own thoughts. I shall so work upon that drunken little blackguard that he will leave Liza with the Pogoryeltseffs and go away alone, at first for a time, of course. And so Liza shall remain behind for me. What more do I want? The plan will suit him, too. Else why does he bully her like this? The carriage arrived at last. It was certainly a very beautiful place. They were met, first of all, by a troop of noisy children, who overflowed onto the front steps. Velchaninoff had not been down for some time, and the delight of the little ones to see him was excessive. They were very fond of him. The elder ones shouted before he had left the carriage, by way of chaff. "How's the lawsuit getting on, eh?" And the smaller gang took up the joke, and all clamoured the same question. It was a pet joke in this establishment to chaff Velchaninoff about his lawsuit. But when Liza climbed down the carriage steps, she was instantly surrounded and stared at with true juvenile curiosity. Then Claudia Petrovna and her husband came out, and both of them good-humouredly bantered Velchaninoff about his lawsuit. Claudia Petrovna was a lady of some 37 summers, stout and well-favoured, and with a sweet, fresh-looking face. Her husband was a man of 55, a clever and long-headed man of the world, but above all, a good and kind-hearted friend to anyone requiring kindness. The Pogoryeltseffs' house was, in the full sense of the word, a home to Velchaninoff, as the latter had stated. There was rather more here, however. For 20 years since, Claudia had very nearly married young Velchaninoff, almost a boy at that time, and a student at the university. This had been his first experience of love, and very hot and fiery and funny and sweet it was. The end of it was, however, that Claudia married Mr. Pogoryeltseff. 5 years later, she and Velchaninoff had met again, and a quiet, candid friendship had sprung up between them. Since then, there had always been a warmth, a speciality about their friendship, a radiance which overspread it and glorified their relations one to the other. There was nothing here that Velchaninoff could remember with shame. All was pure and sweet, and this was perhaps the reason why the friendship was specially dear to Velchaninoff. He had not experienced many such platonic intimacies. In this house, Velchaninoff was simple and happy, confessed his sins, played with the children and lectured them, and never bothered his head about outside matters. He had promised the Pogoryeltseffs that he would live a few more years alone in the world, and then move over to their household for good and all, and he looked forward to that time coming with all seriousness. Velchaninoff now gave all the information about Liza which he thought fit, though his simple request would have been amply sufficient here. Claudia Petrovna kissed the little orphan, and promised to do all she possibly could for her, and the children carried Liza off to play in the garden. Half an hour passed in conversation, and then Velchaninoff rose to depart. He was in such a hurry that his friends could not help remarking upon the fact. He had not been near them for 3 weeks, they said, and now he only stayed half an hour. Velchaninoff laughed and promised to come down tomorrow. Someone observed that Velchaninoff's state of agitation was remarkable, even for him, whereupon the latter jumped up, seized Claudia Petrovna's hand, and, under the pretense of having forgotten to tell her something most important about Liza, he led her into another room. "Do you remember," he began, "what I told you, and only you, even your husband does not know of it, about my year of life down at T.?"
"Oh, yes, only too well. You have often spoken of it."
"No, I did not speak about it. I confessed, and only to yourself. But I never told you the lady's name. It was Trusotsky, the wife of this Trusotsky. It is she who has died, and this little Liza is her child. My child.
Is this certain?
Are you quite sure there is no mistake? Asked Claudia Petrovna with some agitation.
Quite, quite certain, said Velchaninov enthusiastically.
He then gave a short, hasty, and excited narrative of all that had occurred. Claudia had heard it all before, excepting the lady's name. The fact is, Velchaninov had always been so afraid that one of his friends might some fine day meet Madame Trusotsky at tea, and wonder how in the world he could have loved such a woman as that, that he had never revealed her name to a single soul, not even to Claudia Petrovna, his great friend.
"And does the father know nothing of it?"
asked Claudia, having heard the tale out.
"No, he knows. You see, that's just what is bothering me now. I haven't sifted the matter as yet," resumed Velchaninov hotly. "He must know. He does know. I remarked that fact both yesterday and today. But I wish to discover how much he knows. That's why I'm hurrying back now. He is coming tonight. He knows all about Bagantov. But how about myself? You know how such wives can deceive their husbands. If an angel from heaven were to come down and convict a woman, her husband will still trust her and give the angel the lie.
Oh, don't nod your head at me. Don't judge me. I have long since judged and convicted myself. You see, this morning I felt so sure that he knew all, that I compromised myself before him. Fancy! I was really ashamed of having been rude to him last night. He only called in to see me out of the pure, unconquerably malicious desire to show me that he knew all the offence, and knew who was the offender. I behaved like a fool. I gave myself into his hands too easily. I was too heated. He came at such a feverish moment for me. I tell you, he has been bullying Liza, simply to let off bile. You understand? He needs a safety valve for his offended feelings, and vents them upon anyone, even a little child.
It is exasperation, and quite natural. We must treat him in a Christian spirit, my friend. And do you know, I wish to change my way of treating him entirely. I wish to be particularly kind to him. That will be a good action on my part, for I am to blame before him. I know I am. There's no disguising the fact. Besides, once at tea it so happened that I required 4,000 rubles at a moment's notice. Well, the fellow gave me the money, without a receipt at once, and with every manifestation of delight to be able to serve me. And I took the money from his hands. I did, indeed. I took it as though he were a friend. Think of that.
Very well. Only be careful, said Claudia Petrovna. You are so enthusiastic that I am really alarmed for you. Of course, Liza shall now be no less than my own daughter to me, but there is so much to know and to settle yet. Above all, be very careful and observant. You are not nearly careful enough when you are happy. You are much too exalted an individual to be cautious when you are happy, she added with a smile. The whole family went out to see Velchaninov off. The children brought Liza along with them. They had been playing in the garden. They seemed to look at her now with even more perplexity than at first. The girl became dreadfully shy when Velchaninov kissed her before all, and promised to come down next day and bring her father with him. To the last moment she did not say a single word, and never looked at him at all. But just before he was about to start, she seized his hand and drew him away to one side, looking imploringly in his face. She evidently had something to say to him. Velchaninov immediately took her into an adjoining room. "What is it, Liza?" he asked, kindly and encouragingly. But she drew him farther away, into the very farthest corner of the room, anxious to get well out of sight and hearing of the rest. "What is it, Liza? What is it?" But she was still silent, and could not make up her mind to speak. She stared with her motionless, large blue eyes into his face, and in every lineament of her little face was betrayed the wildest terror and anxiety.
"He'll hang himself," she whispered at last, as though she were talking in her sleep.
"Who will hang himself?" asked Velchaninoff in alarm.
"He will. He tried to hang himself to a hook last night," said the child, panting with haste and excitement. "I saw it myself. Today he tried it again. He wishes to hang himself. He told me so. He told me so. He wanted to long ago. He has always wanted to do it. I saw it myself in the night."
"Impossible," muttered Velchaninoff incredulously.
Lisa suddenly threw herself into his arms, kissed his hands, and cried. She could hardly breathe for sobbing. She was begging and imploring Velchaninoff, but he could not understand what she was trying to say. Velchaninoff never afterwards forgot the terrible look of this distressed child. He thought of it waking and thought of it sleeping. How she had come to him in her despair as to her last hope, and hysterically begged and prayed him to help her. And to think of her being so deeply attached to him, he reflected jealously, as he drove impatient and feverish towards town. She said herself that she loved her mother better. Perhaps she hates him and doesn't love him at all. And what's all that nonsense about hanging himself? What did she mean by that? As if he would hang himself, the fool. I must sift the matter, the whole matter. I must settle this business once and forever, and quickly.